Wilbur Larch. "Wouldn't that be pretty, Wilbur?" Nurse Edna asked. "And you could get your own cider press," Wally suggested. "Give the kids fresh apples and fresh cider. They'd have lots to do." "They don't need things to do," thought Dr. Larch. "They need places to go." "They're from some charity," thought Nurse Angela cautiously. She put her lips close to Dr. Larch's ear and whispered, "A sizable donation," just so Dr. Larch wouldn't be rude to them. "They're too young to give their money away," thought Wilbur Larch. "Bees," Wally was saying. "You should keep bees, too. Fascinating for the kids, and a lot safer than most people think. Have your own honey and give the kids an education. Bees are a model society, a lesson in teamwork." "Oh, shut up, Wally," Candy was thinking, although she understood why he couldn't stop babbling. He was unused to an environment he couldn't instantly brighten. He was unused to a place so despairing that it insisted on silence. He was unused to absorbing a shock, to simply taking it in. Wally's talk-a-mile-a-minute style was a good-hearted effort. He believed in improving the world. He had to fix everything, to make everything better. Dr. Larch looked around at the children stuffing themselves with honey and jelly. "Have they come here to play with the orphans for a day and to make everyone sick?" he wondered. He should have looked at Candy. Then he would have known why they were there. He was not good at looking in women's eyes, Wilbur Larch. He had seen too much of them under the harsh lights. Nurse Angela at times wondered if Dr. Larch even knew how he tended to overlook women. She wondered if this was an occupational hazard among obstetricians, or if men with a tendency to overlook women are drawn to the obstetrical field. Homer Wells did not overlook women. He looked right into their eyes, which might have been why, Nurse Angela thought, he seemed to find their position in the stirrups so troubling. Funny, she thought, how he has seen everything that Dr. Larch does, yet he will not watch me or Nurse Edna shave anyone. He was so adamant in arguing with Dr. Larch about shaving the women for abortions. It wasn't necessary, Homer always said, and the women surely didn't like to be shaved. "Like it?" Dr. Larch would say. "Am I in the entertainment business?" Candy felt helpless. No one seemed to understand why she was standing there. Children were colliding with her at hip level, and this awkward, darkly handsome young man, who was surely her own age but somehow seemed older. Was she supposed to tell him why she'd come to St. Cloud's? Couldn't anyone tell just by looking at her? Then Homer Wells looked at her in that way. Their eyes met. Candy thought that he had seen her many times before, that he'd watched her grow up, had seen her naked, had even observed the act responsible for the particular trouble she was now presenting for cure. It was shattering to Homer to recognize in the expression of the beautiful stranger he had fallen in love with something as familiar and pitiable as another unwanted pregnancy. "I think you'd be more comfortable inside," he murmured to her. "Yes, thank you," Candy said, not able to look in his eyes now. Larch, seeing the girl walk toward the hospital entrance, recognizing that deliberate way of walking that predictably happens to someone who's watching her own feet, thought suddenly, "Oh, it's just another abortion, that's all this is about." He turned to follow the girl and Homer, just as Smoky Fields finished the jar of jelly and began to eat a jar of honey. Smoky ate with no apparent satisfaction, but he ate so methodically that even when he was jostled by a nearby orphan, he never took his eyes from his little paw as it scooped its way into the jar. When he was severely jostled, a kind of growl or gurgle caught in his throat, and he hunched his shoulders forward as if to protect the jar from other predators. Homer led the way to Nurse Angela's office. At the threshold, he saw the dead baby's hands reaching above the edge of the white enamel examining tray, which still rested on Nurse Angela's typewriter. The baby's hands were still waiting for the ball, but Homer's reflexes were quick enough. He turned full circle in the doorway, pushing Candy back into the hall. "This is Dr. Larch," Homer said to Candy, introducing them while he herded them down the hall to the dispensary. Wilbur Larch did not remember that there was a dead baby on top of the typewriter in Nurse Angela's office. He said crossly to Homer, "Shouldn't we let Miss Kendall sit down?" He didn't remember that the dead station master was in the dispensary either, and when he saw the moron's muddy shoes, he pulled Homer aside and whispered harshly to him, "Have you no feeling for this poor girl?" Homer whispered back that he thought the partial view of a dead man was preferable to the whole view of a dead baby. "Oh," Wilbur Larch said. "I'll deliver the woman from Damariscotta," Homer added to Larch, still whispering. Well, don't be in too big a hurry, Large whispered.
I mean, I won't have anything to do with this one, Homer whispered back, looking at Candy. I won't even look at her, do you understand?
Dr. Larch regarded the young woman. He thought he understood a little. She was a very pretty young woman, even Dr. Larch could see that, and he'd not seen Homer so agitated in anyone's presence before. Homer fancies he's in love, thought Dr. Larch. Or he fancies that he'd like to be.
Have I been utterly insensitive? Larch wondered. Is the boy still enough of a boy to need to romanticize women? Or is he enough of a man to desire to romance women, too?
Wally was introducing himself to Homer Wells. Wilbur Larch thought, here's the one with apples for brains. Why is he whispering? It didn't occur to Dr. Larch that Wally thought, by his partial view of the station master, that the station master was asleep.
If I could have just a moment's peace with Miss Kendall, said Wilbur Larch, we can all meet each other another time. Edna will assist me with Miss Kendall, please, and Angela, would you help Homer with the Damariscotta woman?
Homer, Dr. Larch explained to Wally and to Candy, is a very accomplished midwife.
You are, Wally said to Homer enthusiastically. Wow!
Homer Wells maintained silence. Nurse Angela, bristling at the word midwife, at the condescension she quite correctly heard in Dr. Larch's tone, touched Homer's arm very gently and said to him,
I'll give you a count of the contractions.
Nurse Edna, whose uncritical love for Dr. Larch beamed forth ever brightly, cheerfully pointed out that various people had to be moved, both from and to various beds, if a room was to be made ready for Candy.
Please do it, then, Dr. Larch said. If I could just have a moment alone with Miss Kendall, he repeated.
But he saw that Homer seemed riveted. Homer was unaware that he was staring at Candy.
The boy has gone gaga on me, thought Wilbur Larch, and he saw no indication that Apple Brains intended to leave the dispensary.
If I could just explain a little of the process to Miss Kendall, Wilbur Larch said to Wally. It appeared hopeless to address Homer.
I'd like her to know about the bleeding later, for example.
Larch added, intending that the word bleeding would have some effect on Wally's apple-bright complexion. It did, perhaps in combination with the overpowering atmosphere of ether in the dispensary.
Is someone going to cut her?
He asked Homer pathetically. Homer caught Wally's arm and pulled him abruptly away. He pulled him so quickly along the hall and got him outdoors so fast that Wally almost escaped being sick at all. As it was, completely owing to Homer's good reflexes, Wally didn't throw up until the two of them were behind the boys' division. On the particular hillside that Wally had suggested planting with apple trees, the very hillside where Homer Wells' shadow had only recently outdistanced Dr. Larch's. The two young men walked up and down and across the hill in straight lines, respecting the rows of trees Wally was planting in his imagination. Homer politely explained the procedure that Candy would undergo, but Wally wanted to talk about apple trees.
This hill is perfect for your standard 40-by-40 plot, Wally said, walking 40 feet in one direction, then making a perfect right-angle turn.
If she's in the first 3 months, Homer noted, there really shouldn't be any work with the forceps, just the standard dilatation. That means dilating the opening to the uterus, and then curetting, that's scraping.
I'd recommend 4 rows of Macintosh, then 1 row of Red Delicious, Wally said. Half of the trees should be Macs. I'd mix up the rest, maybe 10% Red Delicious, another 10 or 15% Cortlands and Baldwins. You want a few Northern Spies, and I'll throw in some Gravensteins. They're a great apple for pies, and you get to pick them early.
There's no actual cutting, Homer told Wally, although there will be some bleeding. We call it spotting, actually, because it's usually not very heavy bleeding. Dr. Larch has a great touch with ether, so don't worry, she won't feel a thing. Of course, she'll feel something afterward, admitted Homer. It's a special sort of cramp. Dr. Larch says that the other discomfort is psychological.
You could come back to the coast with us, Wally told Homer. We could load a truck full of baby trees, and in a day or two we could come back here and plant the orchard together. It wouldn't take too long.
It's a deal, said Homer Wells.
The coast, he thought. I get to see the coast. And the girl. I get to ride in that car with that girl.
A midwife? Gosh, Wally said. I guess you're probably going to be a doctor.
I don't think so, said Homer Wells. I don't know yet.
Well, apples are in my family, Wally said.
I'm going to college, but I really don't know why I bother.
College, thought Homer Wells.
Candy's father is a lobsterman, Wally explained, but she's going to go to college, too.
Lobster, thought Homer Wells. The bottom of the sea. From the bottom of the hill, Nurse Angela was waving to them.
Damariscotta is ready, she called to Homer Wells.
I have to go deliver someone's baby, Homer told Wally.
Gosh, Wally said. He seemed reluctant to leave the hill. I think I'll stay up here. I don't think I want to hear anything, he added.
He gave Homer a likable and confessional smile.
Oh, there's not much noise, Homer said.
He wasn't thinking of the Damariscotta woman, he was thinking of Candy. He thought of the gritty sound the curette made, but he'd spare his new friend that detail. He left Wally on the hill and jogged toward Nurse Angela. He looked back at Wally once and waved.
A boy his own age. A boy his own size. They were the same height, although Wally was more muscular.
From sports, Dr. Larch had guessed. He has the body of a hero, Dr. Larch thought, remembering the heroes he had tried to help in France in World War I. Lean but well-muscled, that was a hero's body. And shot full of holes, thought Wilbur Larch. He didn't know why Wally's body reminded him of this.
And Wally's face? Wilbur Larch was thinking. It was handsome in a finer way than Homer's face, which was also handsome. Although Wally's body was stronger, his bones were somewhat sharper and more delicate. There wasn't a trace of anger in Wally's eyes. They were the eyes of good intentions. The body of a hero and the face of a benefactor, concluded Wilbur Larch, brushing aside a blonde curl of pubic hair that had not gone directly into the refuse bag, but had clung to Candy's inner thigh near her raised bent knee. He exchanged the medium-sized curette for the smaller one, noting that the girl's eyelids were fluttering, noting Nurse Edna's gentle thumbs, massaging the girl's temples, and the girl's slightly parted lips. She had been remarkably relaxed for such a young girl, and under ether she was even more composed. The beauty in her face, Larch thought, was that she was still free of guilt. It surprised Larch how Candy looked as if she would always be free of it. He was aware of Nurse Edna observing the scrutiny he was giving to the girl, and so he bent once more to the view the speculum afforded him and finished his task with the small curette. A benefactor, thought Wilbur Larch. Homer has met his benefactor. Homer Wells was thinking on parallel lines. I have met a prince of Maine, he was thinking. I have seen a king of New England. And I am invited to his castle. In all his journeys through David Copperfield, at last he understood young David's first vision of Steerforth. He was a person of great power in my eyes, young Copperfield observed. No veiled future glanced upon him in the moonbeams. There was no shadowy picture of his footsteps in the garden that I dreamed of walking in all night. No veiled future, thought Homer Wells. I am going to the coast. Push, he said to the woman from Damariscotta. Is Damariscotta on the coast?
He asked the woman, whose neck was taut with straining, who held Nurse Angela's hand in a white-knuckled grip.
Near it,
the woman cried, and shoved her child forth into St. Cloud's, its slick head captured perfectly in the palm of Homer's confident right hand. He slipped the heel of his hand under the baby's fragile neck. His left hand lifted the baby's bottom as he guided the baby outdoors, as Dr. Larch would say. It was a boy. Steerforth, Homer Wells would name this one. His second solo delivery. Homer cut the cord and smiled to hear young Steerforth's healthy bawling. Candy, coming out of ether, heard the baby's cries and shuddered. If Dr. Larch had seen her face at that moment, he might have detected some guilt upon it.
"Boy or girl?" she asked,
her speech slurred. Only Nurse Edna heard her.
"Why is it crying?" Candy asked.
"It was nothing, dear," Nurse Edna said. "It's all over."
"I would like to have a baby one day," Candy said. "I really would."
"Why, of course, dear," Nurse Edna told her. "You can have as many as you want. I'm sure you'd have very beautiful children."
"You'll have princes of Maine," Dr. Larch told Candy suddenly. "You'd have kings of New England."
"Why, the old goat," Nurse Edna thought. "He's flirting." Her love for Larch felt momentarily ruffled.
What a strange idea, Candy thought. I can't see what they would look like.
Her mind drifted for a while.
Why is the baby crying? She wondered.
Wilbur Larch, cleaning up, noticed another curly clump of her pubic hair. It was the same tawny tone of Candy's skin, which was doubtlessly why Nurse Edna had missed it. He listened to the cries of the Damariscotta woman's baby and thought that he mustn't be selfish. He must encourage Homer to make friends with this young couple. He stole a look at the dozing girl. Opportunity shone from her like light.
"And people will always eat apples," he thought. "It must be a nice life."
The apple enameled on the Cadillac's door, and monogrammed in gold, was of special interest to Melanie, who managed to prod herself into action. She tried to steal the apple on the door before she realized it wouldn't come off. Mary Agnes's arrival at the girls' division, with her scrawny arms hoarding jars of jelly and honey, had prompted Melanie to go see for herself what was going on. She thought sourly how it was typical how nothing had been left for her, not even a glimpse of the beautiful people. She wouldn't have minded another look at them. There was nothing worth stealing, she could see at a glance, just an old book. It was fate, she would think later, that the title of the book and the name of its author were visible to her. The book appeared discarded on the car's floor. Little Dorrit meant nothing to Melanie, but Charles Dickens was a name she recognized. He was a kind of hero to Homer Wells. Without thinking that this was her life's first unselfish act, she stole the book, for Homer. At the time, she wasn't even thinking how it might impress him, how it might gain for her some favorable light in his eyes. She thought only generously, "Oh, look, a present for sunshine." It meant more to her than she could ever admit to herself, that Homer had promised never to leave St. Cloud's without her. Then she saw Wally. He was walking toward the Cadillac in the direction of the hospital entrance, but he kept turning around to look at the hill. In his mind, he saw the orchard at harvest time. The long ladders were in the trees, the pickers were the orphans themselves. The bushel crates were stacked in the rows between the trees. In one row, a tractor towed a flatbed trailer, already heavy with apples. It looked like a good crop. Where will they get a tractor? Wally wondered. He tripped, caught his balance, looked where he was walking, toward the abandoned Cadillac. Melanie was gone. She'd lost her nerve. The thought of confronting that handsome young man, alone... She wasn't sure if she could have tolerated his indifference. If he'd been clearly appalled by her appearance, that wouldn't have bothered Melanie. She rather enjoyed her ability to shock people. But she could not bear the thought that he might not even notice her. And if he'd handed her a jar of honey, she'd have cracked his skull with it. "Nobody honeys me," she thought. Little Dorrit slipped inside her shirt, against her thudding heart. She crossed the road between the boys' and girls' divisions, just as the stationmaster's assistant was climbing the same road toward the hospital. At first she didn't recognize him. He was so dressed up. To Melanie he was just a simpleton in overalls, a busybody who tried to fashion for himself an air of self-importance out of what Melanie imagined was the world's stupidest job, watching for trains to arrive and then watching them leave. The loneliness of the railroad station depressed Melanie. She avoided the place. "You went there for one thing, to leave. But to stand there all day, imagining leaving, could there be anything sadder or more stupid than that? And now here was this oaf, still wearing his year-long effort to grow a mustache, but dressed to kill. Well, no, Melanie realized. He's dressed for a funeral." That was it. The plain but ambitious boy had been impressed by the white Cadillac. He'd conceived that the stationmaster's job was his for the taking if he exhibited a proper and adult solemnity regarding the stationmaster's passing. He was terrified of Dr. Larch, and the idea of pregnant women made him feel furtive, but he had imagined that paying his respects at the orphanage, where the stationmaster's body reposed, was a grueling but necessary rite of passage. The spit-up smell he associated with babies made him nauseous, too. An unusual bravery had guided him to the orphanage, giving his silly young face an almost adult countenance, except for the silky smudge that marred his upper lip and made all his efforts at manhood ridiculous. He had also burdened himself for the uphill climb by carrying all the catalogues. The stationmaster wouldn't be needing them now, and his assistant imagined that he could ingratiate himself to Dr. Larch by bringing the catalogues as a present, a kind of peace offering. He had not bothered to consider what use Wilbur Larch would have for seeds and lingerie, or how the old doctor would respond to declarations regarding the peril of souls. his own and many restless others. The two orphans the station master's assistant most despised were Homer and Melanie. Homer, because his serenity gave him a confident, adult appearance that the assistant felt powerless to achieve, and Melanie because she mocked him. Now, to make a bad day worse, here was Melanie, blocking his way.
"What's that on your lip, a fungus?" Melanie asked him. "Maybe you should wash it."
She was bigger than the station master's assistant, especially now that she stood uphill from him. He tried to ignore her.
"I've come to view the body," he said with dignity.
Had he any sense, he would have known these words were ill-chosen for presentation to Melanie.
"One of you my body?" she asked him.
"I'm not kidding," she added, when she saw how lost he was and frightened. Melanie had an instinct for pressing any advantage, but she relented when her adversary was too easy. She saw that the station master's assistant would go on standing in the road until he dropped from fatigue, and so she stepped aside for him and said, "I was kidding." He stumbled ahead, blushing, and had almost turned the corner by the boys' division when she called after him,
"You'd have to shave before I'd let you."
He staggered slightly, causing Melanie to marvel at her power. Then he turned the corner and felt himself uplifted by the gleaming Cadillac, by what he mistook for the white hearse. If, at that moment, a choir had erupted into heavenly voice, the assistant would have fallen to his knees, the catalogues spilling around him. The same light that blessed the Cadillac seemed to shine forth from the blonde hair of the powerful-looking young man, the driver of the hearse. Now there was a responsibility that awed the station master's assistant. He approached Wally carefully. Wally was leaning on the Cadillac, smoking a cigarette, and intently visualizing an apple orchard in St. Cloud's. The station master's assistant, who looked like a mortician's ghoulish lackey, surprised Wally.
"I've come to view the body," the assistant said.
"The body?" Wally said. "What body?" A fear of embarrassing himself almost paralyzed the station master's assistant. The world, he imagined, was brimming with etiquette beyond his grasp. Obviously, it had been tactless to mention the body of the deceased to the very man who was responsible for safely driving the dead away.
"A thousand pardons," the assistant blurted.
It had been something he'd read.
"A thousand what?" Wally said, growing alarmed. "How thoughtless of me," said the station master's assistant, bowing unctuously and sliding toward the hospital entrance.
"Has someone died?" Wally asked anxiously. But the assistant managed to slip inside the hospital entrance, where he quickly hid himself in a corner of the wall, and wondered what to do next. Clearly he'd upset the high-strung and fine-tuned feelings of the hearse driver. "This is a delicate business," the assistant thought, trying to calm himself. "What mistake will I make next?" He cowered in the corner of the hall, where he could smell ether wafting from the nearby dispensary. He had no idea that the body he wished to view was less than 15 feet from him. He thought he could smell babies, too. He heard one bawling. He thought that babies were born while women had their legs straight up, the soles of their feet facing the ceiling. This vision pinned him to the corner of the hall. "I smell blood," he imagined, struggling to control his panic. He clung to the wall like so much plaster, so much so that Wally failed to notice him when he came in the hospital entrance, worried about who had died. Wally entered the dispensary, as if drawn to the ether, although he quickly felt his nausea returning. He apologized to the feet of the station master.
"Oh, excuse me," Wally whispered, reeling back into the hall.
He heard Nurse Angela talking to Candy, who was already able to sit up. Wally barged in on them, but the look of relief on his face, to see that Candy was not the person rumored to be dead, was so touching to Nurse Angela that she wasn't even cross with him for intruding.
"Please come in," she said to Wally, in her best hospital voice, which was first-person plural.
"We're feeling much better now," Nurse Angela said. "We're not quite ready to jump around, but we're sitting up nicely, aren't we?" she asked Candy, who smiled. Candy was so clearly glad to see Wally that Nurse Angela felt she should leave them alone. St. Cloud's did not have a great and tender history regarding the presence of couples in that operating room, and Nurse Angela was both surprised and happy to see a man and a woman who loved each other. "I can clean up later," she thought, "or I'll ask Homer to do it." Homer and Dr. Larch were talking. Nurse Edna had taken the Damariscotta woman back to her bed in the maternity ward, and Dr. Larch was examining the baby Homer Wells had delivered. Young Steerforth, a name Dr. Larch had already criticized. There was some villainy in the character of Steerforth, or had Homer forgotten that part, and there was also a death by drowning. It was more of a brand than a name, in Dr. Larch's opinion. But they weren't talking any more about Steerforth. "Wally said it would take just a couple of days," Homer Wells was saying. "We'll have to load a truck, I guess. There's going to be 40 trees, and I'd like to see the coast."
"Of course you should go, Homer. It's a great opportunity," Dr. Larch said.
He poked Steerforth in the belly with a finger. Then he tempted Steerforth into gripping one of his other fingers. Then he shone a little light in Steerforth's eyes.
"I'd be gone just 2 days," Homer Wells said.
Wilbur Larch shook his head. At first Homer thought there was something wrong with Steerforth.
"Maybe just 2 days, Homer," Dr. Larch said. "You should be prepared to take advantage of the situation. You should not let an opportunity pass you by in just 2 days."
Homer stared at Dr. Larch, but Larch was peering into Steerforth's ears.
"If this young couple likes you, Homer, and if you like them..."
"Well," Larch said, "I think you'll be meeting their parents, too, and if their parents like you, well..." said Dr. Larch.
"I think you should try to make their parents like you."
He would not look at Homer, who was staring at him. Dr. Larch examined the tied end of the umbilical, while Steerforth cried and cried.
"I think we both know it would do you good to get away for more than 2 days, Homer," Dr. Larch said. "You understand, I'm not talking about an adoption. I'm talking about the possibility of a summer job, for a start. Someone might offer you the means to stay away for more than 2 days, that's all I'm saying, if that's an attractive prospect."
Dr. Larch looked at Homer. They stared at each other.
"Right," Homer finally said. "Of course, you might want to come back in 2 days," Larch said heartily, but they looked away from each other, as they chose to look away from the likelihood of that.
"In which case," Larch said, washing his hands, "you know you're always welcome here." He left the room, and Homer with the baby, too quickly again for Homer to say how much he loved him. The cowering stationmaster's assistant watched Wilbur Larch take Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna into the dispensary. Perhaps, despite the stationmaster's presence, the etherized atmosphere of the dispensary was comforting to Wilbur Larch, and helped him to say to his loyal nurses what he needed to say.
"I want to pool our resources," said Wilbur Larch. "I want the boy to have as much money as we can scrounge together, and whatever there is in the way of clothing that looks halfway decent."
"Just for 2 days, Wilbur?" Nurse Edna asked.
"How much money does the boy need for 2 days?" Nurse Angela asked.
"It's an opportunity for him, don't you see?" Dr. Larch asked. "I don't think he'll be back here in 2 days. I hope he doesn't come back. At least, not that soon,"
said Wilbur Larch, whose breaking heart reminded him of what he'd forgotten, the story of Homer's weak heart. How could he tell him? Where and when? He crossed the hall to see how Candy was coming along. He knew that she and Wally wanted to leave as soon as possible. They had a long drive ahead of them.
"And if Homer Wells is leaving me," thought Wilbur Larch, "he'd better leave me in a hurry." Although 20 years, Dr. Larch knew, wasn't what most would have called a hurried departure.
Homer had to leave in a hurry now, because Dr. Larch needed to see if he would ever get over it.
"I don't think so," he thought.
He checked the spotting on the sterile Volvo pad, while Wally looked at the ceiling, at his hands, at the floor.
"You're doing just fine," Dr. Larch told Candy.
He was about to tell her that Homer could advise her about any cramp she suffered, and that Homer could also check her for spotting, but he wanted to leave Homer free of that responsibility. Also, Dr. Larch couldn't at the moment have said Homer's name.
"They're taking you?"
Curly Day asked Homer, when Curly saw Homer packing.
"I'm not being adopted, Curly," said Homer Wells. "I'll be back in just 2 days." "They're taking you," said Curly Day.
His face looked so stricken, Homer had to turn away. Dr. Larch was an amateur historian, but he nonetheless understood the power of information that is received indirectly. For that reason, he told Candy and Wally about Homer's weak heart. It was not only easier for Dr. Larch than lying to Homer. In the long run, Larch suspected the story would be more convincing. I've never let him go before, not even for just 2 days, without saying just a little about his condition, Dr. Larch told Candy and Wally. A wonderful word, condition. The effect of the word in a doctor's mouth is truly astonishing. Candy seemed to forget she just had an abortion. The color came back to Wally's face. It's his heart, said Wilbur Larch. I've not told him about it because I haven't wanted to worry him. It's the sort of condition that could be made worse by his worrying about it, Dr. Larch confided to these two good-hearted innocents, who gave him their rapt attention. Just so he's not exposed to anything too strenuous, or to anything too violent in the way of exercise, or to anything too shocking, said Wilbur Larch, who had created a perfect history for someone who simply needed to be careful, who needed to stay out of danger. Larch had given his favorite orphan a history that he hoped would keep him safe. He was aware that it was a history a father would construct for his son, if a father could make his son believe it. Homer Wells, at the moment, couldn't construct a history or anything else that would be soothing to Curly Day, who buried himself under several pillows and a blanket and sobbed.
"What do you need to be adopted for?" Curly cried. "You're practically a doctor."
"It's just for 2 days," Homer Wells repeated. With each repetition, his promise sounded less and less likely.
"They're taking you! I can't believe it!" cried Curly Day.
Nurse Angela came and sat beside Homer on Curly's bed. Together they regarded the sobbing mound under the blanket.
"It's just for 2 days, Curly," Nurse Angela said lamely.
"Dr. Larch said Homer was here to protect us," Curly cried. "Some protection!"
Nurse Angela whispered to Homer that if he'd go clean up the operating table, she'd sit with Curly until he felt better. She'd not wanted to clean up the table while the nice young couple needed to be alone.
"Your friends seem to be having a nice moment together," Nurse Angela whispered to Homer Wells.
"My friends," he thought. "Is it possible I'm going to be having friends?"
"You're not the best one, Homer," Curly cried under the blanket.
"Right," Homer said. He tried to pat Curly, but Curly stiffened and held his breath. "I'll see you, Curly," Homer said.
"Traitor!"
cried Curly Day. Curly seemed to recognize Nurse Angela's touch. His rigid body relaxed, and he gave himself over to a steady sobbing. Nurse Edna had finally stopped young Steerforth from crying, or she had simply outlasted the baby, who was now washed and dressed and almost asleep in Nurse Edna's arms. He had taken enough of the formula to satisfy Nurse Edna, and so she put him in his bed and finished cleaning the room where he'd been delivered. As soon as she'd put a fresh sheet on the table, she was just wiping the gleaming stirrups, Dr. Larch lurched into the room with the station master's stiff body, a somewhat pliable plank over his shoulder.
"Wilbur," Nurse Edna said critically, "you should let Homer help you with that."
"It's time to get used to not having Homer around," Dr. Larch said curtly, dropping the station master's body on the table.
"Oh, dear," Nurse Edna thought, "we're in for a ferocious time of it."
"I don't suppose you've seen the sternum shears," Dr. Larch asked her.
"The snips?" she asked.
"They're called shears," he said. "If you'd just undress him, I'll ask Homer."
Homer knocked before he entered the operating room, where Candy had dressed herself, with Wally's fumbling help, and now stood leaning against him in what struck Homer as an oddly formal pose, as if the couple had just finished a dance competition and were awaiting the judge's applause.
"You can relax now," said Homer Wells, not quite able to look at Candy's face. "Maybe you'd like some fresh air. I won't be long. I have to clean the table." As an awkward second thought, he added to Candy, "You're feeling all right, aren't you?"
"Oh, yes," she said, her eyes passing over Homer very quickly. She smiled reassuringly at Wally. That was when Dr. Larch came in and asked Homer if he knew where the sternum shears were.
"They're with Clara," Homer admitted. "I'm sorry," he added quickly. "I had them there because I thought I might need them for the autopsy. On the fetus," he added.
"You don't use sternum shears on a fetus," Dr. Larch said.
"I know, I used the scissors," said Homer Wells, who was aware that the words fetus and autopsy fell like drops of blood on Wally and Candy.
"I'll go get the shears for you," Homer said to Dr. Larch.
"No, finish what you're doing here," Larch said. "You two should get some fresh air," he said to Wally and Candy,
who took his suggestion for a command, which it was. They left the operating room. On the way down the hall to the hospital entrance, they would have spotted the station master's assistant, lurking in his corner, had the assistant not been so unnerved by the sight of Dr. Larch carrying the station master's body out of the dispensary that he had cautiously attempted to follow this troubling vision. In his fear, he made a wrong turn and found himself in the dispensary. He was staring at the mud on the sheet at the foot of the bed when Wally led Candy outdoors. "If you're so sure it was his heart," Homer Wells was asking Dr. Larch, "why are you in such a hurry to do the autopsy?" "I like to keep busy," Larch said, surprised by the barely restrained anger in his own voice. He might have told Homer then that he loved him very much and that he needed something very active to occupy himself at this moment of Homer's departure. He might have confessed to Homer Wells that he wanted very much to lie down on his own bed in the dispensary and administer a little ether to himself, but that he couldn't very well have done that while the station master had occupied his bed. He wanted to take Homer Wells in his arms and hug him and kiss him, but he could only hope that Homer understood how much Dr. Larch's self-esteem was dependent on his self-control. And so he said nothing. He left Homer alone in the operating room while he went to find the sternum shears. Homer scrubbed the table with disinfectant. He had sealed the refuse bag when he noticed the almost transparent blondness of the clump of pubic hair that clung to his pant leg. A tight, clean curl of Candy's especially fine hair was caught on his knee. He held it up to the light, then put it in his pocket. Nurse Edna was crying as she undressed the station master. Dr. Larch had told her and Nurse Angela that there would be no hoopla of heartfelt well-wishing upon the departure of Homer Wells, nothing that would lead Candy and Wally to suspect that Homer Wells was even considering he might be gone more than 2 days. "Nothing," Dr. Larch had said. "No hugs, no kisses," thought Nurse Edna, weeping. Her tears had no influence on the expression of the station master, whose face remained seized by fear. Nurse Edna completely ignored the station master. She devoted herself to her misery at being forbidden to gush over saying goodbye to Homer Wells. "We will all appear casual about his leaving," Dr. Larch had said. "Period." "Casual," Nurse Edna thought. The station master was down to his socks when Dr. Larch walked in with the sternum shears. "There will be no crying," he said sternly to her. "Do you want to give everything away?" She yanked off the station master's socks and threw them at Dr. Larch. Then she left him alone with the body. Homer Wells gave the operating table a thorough inspection, a final examination, a last look. He transferred the cluster of Candy's pubic hair from his pocket to his wallet. He once more counted the money Dr. Larch had given him. It was almost $50. He went back to the boy's sleeping room. Nurse Angela still sat on the edge of the bed where Curly Day was still sobbing. She kissed Homer without altering the motion of her hand, which was rubbing Curly Day's back through the blanket. Homer kissed her and left her without a word.
"I can't believe they took him," murmured Curly Day through his tears.
"He'll be back," whispered Nurse Angela soothingly. "Our Homer," she thought. "I know he'll be back. Doesn't he know where he belongs?" Nurse Edna, attempting to compose herself, stepped into the dispensary, where she encountered the trembling station master's assistant. "May I help you?" Nurse Edna asked, pulling herself together. "I've come to view the body," mumbled the assistant. From across the hall, Nurse Edna heard the familiar crack of the sternum shears splitting the station master's chest. She doubted that the assistant would care to view the body in its present state. What she said to the assistant was, "Dr. Larch isn't finished with the autopsy." "I brought some catalogs for Dr. Larch," the assistant said, handing the mess to Nurse Edna. "Why, thank you," she said, but the young goon in his funeral finery showed no signs of leaving. Perhaps the ether in the dispensary air was unraveling him. "Would you like to wait?" Nurse Edna asked him. He stared at her. "To view the body," she reminded him. "You could wait in Nurse Angela's office." He nodded gratefully as Nurse Edna pointed the way down the hall. "The last door on your right," she told him. "Just make yourself comfortable." Unburdened of the station master's catalogs, the assistant had a lighter, more relaxed step as he aimed himself toward Nurse Angela's office. He was pleased to see there was a choice of chairs to sit in. Naturally, he would not choose the desk chair behind the typewriter, but there were two lower, more comfortable-looking chairs positioned in front of the desk and the typewriter. They were the chairs that the prospective foster parents sat in when they were being interviewed. They were unmatched paisley easy chairs, and the station master's assistant chose the lower, more overstuffed one. He regretted his decision as soon as he felt how very low the chair was. Everything in the cluttered office seemed to loom over him. If Dr. Larch had been sitting at the desk, at the typewriter, he would have towered over the assistant in his low-sunk chair. The assistant saw a white enamel sort of pan or tray upon the typewriter, but he was seated so very low that he couldn't view the pan's contents. Two tiny hands reached above the edge of the examining tray, but only the fingertips of the dead baby from Three Mile Falls were visible to the station master's assistant. He had never seen a fetus before, or even a newborn baby. He was unprepared for how small the fingers can be. He kept looking around the room from his sunken and growingly uncomfortable position, but his eyes kept coming back to the fingertips sticking above the rim of the examining tray. He couldn't believe he was really looking at fingers. "Whatever that is, it looks like fingers," he thought. Gradually, he stopped looking at the other things in the room. He stared at the fingertips. A part of his mind said, "Get up and see what that is." Another part of his mind made his body feel sunken into the easy chair and held down there by a great weight. "It can't be fingers," he thought. He kept staring. He kept sitting. Nurse Edna wanted to tell Dr. Larch that he should for once let his feelings speak for him, that he should tell Homer Wells what he felt, but she stood quietly listening at the operating room door. The station master's chest cracked a few more times. This didn't discomfort her. Nurse Edna was a professional, and she could tell by the precision of the snaps she heard that Dr. Larch had chosen to occupy his emotions with a task. "It's his decision," she told herself. She went outside to see how that nice young couple were doing. The young man was doing whatever young men do while peering under the hoods of cars, and the girl was resting, semi-reclined, in the Cadillac's spacious back seat. The convertible top was still down. Nurse Edna bent over Candy and whispered to her, "You're as pretty as a picture." Candy smiled warmly. Nurse Edna could see how exhausted the girl was. "Listen, dear," Nurse Edna said to her, "don't be shy. If you're worried about your spotting," Nurse Edna said to her confidentially, "or if you have any peculiar cramps, speak to Homer about it. Promise me you won't be shy about it, dear, and most certainly if you run a fever. Promise me," Nurse Edna said. "I promise," Candy said, blushing. Melanie was struggling to inscribe the copy of Little Dorrit she had stolen for Homer when she heard Mary Agnes Cork throwing up in the bathroom. "Shut up," Melanie called, but Mary Agnes went on retching. She'd eaten two jars of apple cider jelly, one jar of honey, and another of crabapple jelly. She thought it was the honey that did it. Smokey Fields had already thrown up. He'd eaten all his jars of everything, and a jar belonging to one of the little Walshes. He lay miserably in his bed, listening to Curly Day crying and Nurse Angela talking on and on. "To Homer Sunshine Wells, for the promise you made me," Melanie wrote. She glanced out her window, but there was nothing going on. It wasn't dark. It wasn't time for the two women she'd watched arrive in the morning to be heading downhill for their return train, to wherever. "Love, Melanie," Melanie added, as Mary Agnes groaned and heaved again. "You dumb little bitch pig," Melanie called. Homer Wells walked into the operating room when Wilbur Larch had successfully exposed the station master's heart. Larch was not surprised to see no evidence of heart disease, no dead muscle tissue. "No infarction," he said to Homer without looking up at him. "In short, no damage to the heart of any kind." "The station master had a healthy heart," Dr. Larch announced to Homer Wells. No massive heart attack had dropped the station master, as Larch had suspected. It appeared there had been a very sudden change in the heart's rhythm. "Arrhythmia, I think," Dr. Larch said to Homer Wells. "His heart just stopped, right?" Homer asked. "I think that he suffered some shock or fright," said Wilbur Larch. Homer Wells could believe that, just by looking at the station master's face. "Right," he said. "Of course, there could be a clot in the brain," said Wilbur Larch. "Where should I look?"
he asked Homer familiarly.
"The brainstem," said Homer Wells.
"Right," Wilbur Larch said. "Good boy." When Homer Wells saw the stationmaster's brainstem exposed, he felt that Dr. Larch was busy enough, with both hands, for it to be safe to say what Homer wanted to say.
"I love you," said Homer Wells.
He knew he had to leave the room, then, while he could still see the door, so he started to leave.
"I love you too, Homer," said Wilbur Larch, who for another minute or more could not have seen a blood clot in the brainstem if there had been one to see.
He heard Homer say, "Right," before he heard the door close. In a while, he could make out the brainstem clearly. There was no clot. "Arrhythmia," Wilbur Larch repeated to himself. Then he added, "Right," as if he were now speaking for Homer Wells. Dr. Larch put his instruments aside. He gripped the operating table for a long time.
Outside, Homer Wells stuck his bag in the Cadillac's trunk, smiled at Candy in the back seat, helped Wally raise the convertible's top. It would be dark soon, and especially cold for Candy in the back seat if they left the top down.
"See you in 2 days," Nurse Edna said to Homer, too loudly.
2 days, Homer repeated, too quietly. She pecked his cheek, he patted her arm.
Nurse Edna then turned and trotted to the hospital entrance. Both Candy and Wally appeared impressed that the woman could move so quickly. When she was inside the hospital, Nurse Edna went directly to the dispensary and threw herself on the bed. If she had a soft heart, she had a strong stomach. It hardly mattered to her that the stationmaster's body had spent much of the day on that bed, or that the mud from his boots had soiled the top sheet. Dr. Larch was still gripping the operating table when he heard the stationmaster's assistant scream. There was just one scream, followed by a prolonged series of whimpers. Homer and Candy and Wally never heard the scream. Wally had already started the car. The assistant had waited the longest time before forcing himself out of the deep, low chair. He had not wanted to look more closely at the contents of the white enameled examining tray, but the little fingers had beckoned to him, and he had felt himself drawn to the tray, where a full and close-up view of the opened-up fetus had caused him, like Curly Day, to wet his pants. He screamed when he discovered that his legs wouldn't move. The only way he could manage to leave Nurse Angela's office was on all fours. He went whimpering down the hall like a beaten dog. Dr. Larch blocked his way at the operating room door.
"What is the matter with you?" Larch asked the assistant scathingly.
"I brought you in all his catalogs,"
the stationmaster's assistant managed to say while still on all fours.
"Catalogs?" said Larch with evident distaste.
"Stand up, man. What's wrong with you?"
He seized the quaking assistant under his armpits and drew him, trembling, to his feet.
"I just wanted to view the body,"
the assistant protested weakly.
Wilbur Larch shrugged.
"What is this fascination the world has with death?" he wondered, but he stepped aside, ushering the assistant into the operating room where the stationmaster, with his heart and his brainstem very well exposed, was instantly in view.
"A sudden change in the heart's rhythm," Wilbur Larch explained. "Something frightened him to death." It was not hard for the assistant to imagine being frightened to death, although he thought that the stationmaster appeared to have been run over by a train, or else had fallen victim to the same evil responsible for the hideous baby upon the typewriter.
"Thank you,"
the assistant whispered to Dr. Larch, then ran so fast down the hall and outdoors that the sound of his footsteps roused Nurse Edna from her weeping. Her own crying had prevented her from hearing the assistant's screams or his whimpers. It seemed to Nurse Angela that nothing would console Curly Day, and so she attempted to make herself comfortable on his narrow bed, believing she was in for a long night. Dr. Larch sat in his usual place at the typewriter. The fetus displayed by Homer Wells disturbed him not in the slightest. Perhaps he appreciated that Homer had left something behind that would need attention. "Busy work, busy work, give me busy work," thought Wilbur Larch. Just before night fell, he leaned forward in his chair enough to turn on the desk lamp. Then he settled back in the chair in which he had spent so many evenings. He appeared to be waiting for someone. It was not yet dark, but he could hear an owl outside, very distinctly. He knew the wild wind from the coast must have dropped. When it was still light, Melanie looked out her window and saw the Cadillac pass. The passenger side of the car faced the girls' division, and Melanie had no trouble recognizing Homer Wells in the passenger seat. His profile turned to her. He sat rigidly, as if he were holding his breath. He was. If he had seen her, or worse, if he had needed to speak to her in order to finalize his escape, he knew he couldn't have succeeded in saying to her that he would be back in just 2 days. Melanie knew what a lie was and what a promise was, and she knew the instant that a promise was broken. She saw a flash of the beautiful girl with the long legs in the back seat of the car, and she supposed that the handsome young man was driving. She had a longer, better look at the profile of Homer Wells. When she slammed the stolen copy of Little Dorrit shut, the ink was still wet and her inscription was smudged. She threw the book against the wall, which only Mrs. Grogan heard. Mary Agnes was still violently ill and too much surrounded by her own noise. Melanie put herself straight to bed without her dinner. Mrs. Grogan, worried about her, went to Melanie's bed and felt her forehead, which was feverish, but Mrs. Grogan could not coax Melanie to drink anything. All Melanie said was, "He broke his promise." Later, she said, "Homer Wells has left St. Cloud's." "You have a little temperature, dear," said Mrs. Grogan, but when Homer Wells didn't come to read Jane Eyre aloud that evening, Mrs. Grogan started paying closer attention. She allowed Melanie to read to the girls that evening. Melanie's voice was oddly flat and passionless. Melanie's reading from Jane Eyre depressed Mrs. Grogan, especially when she read this part. "It is madness in all women to let a secret love kindle within them, which, if unreturned and unknown, must devour the life that feeds it." "Why, the girl didn't bat an eye," Mrs. Grogan observed. Nurse Angela had hardly any more success reading aloud to the boys' division from Dickens. Dickensian description was too strenuous for her. She got lost in the longer passages, and when she had to keep going back to the beginning, she saw the boys were losing interest. Nurse Edna tried her best with the nightly benediction. Dr. Larch refused to leave Nurse Angela's office. He said he was listening to an owl, and he wanted to keep listening. Nurse Edna felt extremely self-conscious with the benediction, which she'd never fully understood in the first place. She took it to be a kind of private joke between Dr. Larch and the universe. Her voice was too shrill and startled sick little Smoky Fields out of sleep and produced a long, loud wail from Curly Day before Curly returned to his more steady sobbing. "Good night, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England," Nurse Edna peeped. "Where is Homer?" several voices whispered, while Nurse Angela continued to rub Curly Day between his shoulder blades in the darkness. Nurse Edna, extremely agitated by Dr. Larch's behavior, got up the nerve to march right down to Nurse Angela's office. She was going to walk right in and tell Dr. Larch that he should go give himself a good snort of ether and then get a good night's sleep. But Nurse Edna grew more timid as she approached the solitary light shining from the office. Nurse Edna hadn't known about the fetal autopsy either, and when she rather cautiously peered into Nurse Angela's office, she was given quite a turn by the gruesome fetus. Dr. Larch just sat at the typewriter, unmoving. He was composing in his mind the first of many letters he would write to Homer Wells. He was attempting to gentle his anxieties and calm his thoughts. "Please be healthy. Please be happy. Please be careful," Wilbur Larch was thinking, the darkness edging in around him, the supplicant hands of the murdered baby from Three Mile Falls reaching out to him. Chapter 6. Ocean View. For the first 2 weeks that Homer Wells was gone from St. Cloud's, Wilbur Larch let the mail pile up unanswered. Nurse Angela struggled with the longer and denser sentences of Charles Dickens, which had a curious effect on the boys' attention. They hung on her every word, holding their breath for the errors they anticipated. And Mrs. Grogan suffered Melanie's deadpan rendition of Charlotte Bronte. Near the end of Chapter 27, Mrs. Grogan could detect a bare minimum of Jane Eyre's indomitable spirit in Melanie's voice. "I care for myself," Melanie read. "The more solitary, the more friendless, the more unsustained I am, the more I will respect myself." "Good girl," thought Mrs. Grogan. "Please be a good girl."
She told Dr. Larch that, although Melanie's reading voice depressed her, Melanie should be encouraged. She should be given more responsibility. Nurse Angela said she'd be glad to give up on Dickens. Dr. Larch surprised them all. When Homer Wells had gone for 3 weeks, Dr. Larch announced that he didn't give a damn who read what to whom. He had ceased to care about the benediction altogether, and so Nurse Edna, although it would never feel quite natural to her, persisted with the nightly salutation to the imagined princes of Maine, the dear little kings of New England. Mrs. Grogan became so firmly transfixed by Melanie's reading voice that she now accompanied Melanie to the boys' division and listened, with the nervous boys, to Melanie read Dickens. Melanie's voice was too even-pitched for Dickens. She plodded her way. She made no mistakes, but she never adjusted her cadence. She presented bustle and sunshine with the same heavy speech she used for gloom and fog. By her stern countenance, Mrs. Grogan saw that Melanie was analyzing as she read. But the subject of her analysis was not Charles Dickens. Melanie was searching through Dickens for specific characteristics she associated with Homer Wells. Sometimes, by the intense concentration on Melanie's face, Melanie seemed close to discovering Homer's whereabouts in the England of another century. Dr. Larch had told Melanie that Homer's actual whereabouts were not her business. Never mind that Melanie murdered every moment of Dickensian wit with her ferocity, or that the rich and colorful details of character and place were turned uniformly drab by her voice. "The girl has no lilt," Nurse Edna complained. Never mind, the boys were terrified of Melanie, and their fears made them pay more attention to her than they had ever paid to Homer Wells. Sometimes the interest in the literature isn't in the literature. The boys' division was an audience like any other. Self-interest, personal memories, their secret anxieties crept into their perceptions of what they heard, regardless of what Charles Dickens had done and what Melanie did to him. Not feeling completely comfortable with leaving the girls' division unattended while she trotted to the boys to hear Melanie read, Mrs. Grogan developed the habit of following the excerpt from Jane Eyre with a short prayer that clung, both lovely and ominous, to the pale and stained bedspreads on which the moonlight glowed long after Melanie and Mrs. Grogan had left the girls to themselves. Even Mary Agnes Cork was struck silent, if not exactly rendered well-behaved, by Mrs. Grogan's prayer. If Mrs. Grogan had known that the prayer was English in origin, she might not have used it. She had heard it on the radio and memorized it, and she always spoke it to herself before she allowed herself to sleep. The prayer was written by Cardinal Newman. When Melanie started to read to the boys, Mrs. Grogan made her personal prayer public. "O Lord," she said in the hall light, in the open doorway, while Melanie stood restlessly beside her, "O Lord, support us all the day long, until the shadows lengthen and the evening comes, and the busy world is hushed, and the fever of life is over, and our work is done. Then in thy mercy grant us a safe lodging and a holy rest, and peace at the last." "Amen," Melanie would say, not quite facetiously, but certainly not reverentially. She said it the way she read from Charlotte Bronte and from Charles Dickens. It gave Mrs. Grogan a chill, although the summer nights were warm and humid, and she needed to take 2 steps for every one of Melanie's just to keep pace with Melanie on her determined journey to the boys' division. The way Melanie said "Amen" was the way she said everything. Hers was a voice without a soul, Mrs. Grogan thought, her teeth chattering as she sat in a chair in the boys' division, slightly out of the light, behind Melanie, watching her broad back. Something in Mrs. Grogan's transfixed appearance may have been responsible for the rumor begun in the boys' division, possibly by Curly Day. That Mrs. Grogan had never gone to school, was actually illiterate, was incapable of reading even a newspaper to herself, and was, therefore, in Melanie's control. The little boys, lying frightened in their beds, felt that they were in Melanie's control, too. Nurse Edna was so disquieted by Melanie's reading that she couldn't wait to launch into her Princes of Maine and Kings of New England refrain, even if she didn't know what it meant. Nurse Edna suggested that Melanie was to blame for an increase in nightmares in the boys' division, and that she should be removed from her responsibilities as reader. Nurse Angela disagreed. If Melanie persisted in casting an evil presence, it was because she'd not been given enough responsibility. Also, Nurse Angela said, maybe there weren't more nightmares. With Homer Wells gone, it had now been a month, perhaps it was simply that Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela heard those suffering from night terrors. In the past, Homer heard them first and tended to them.